Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have Dr. Rafael Medoff, who's the founding director of the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies in Washington, D.C., a very prolific author, writer about Jewish history and Zionism. And he has written a very interesting article. We're going to talk about the early years of the Orthodox Union. Dr. Medoff, how are you today?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I am doing terrific and wonderful. And I want to talk a little bit about your article that you wrote, a fascinating, about what life was like, I mean, in America, what they call the Treth Medina. So what period of time are we actually going to be covering now?
Well, the OU was established in 1898. So we're talking about Orthodox Jewish life in America in the late 1800s and the early decades of the 20th century.
And the people who came during that period of time, I mean, they came only to, you know, seek religious freedom, or was it just really the gold in the Medina where the streets were lined with gold and all you had to do was just pick up some pieces and you were a millionaire?
Well, most of the Jewish immigrants who came in the late 1800s and early 1900s were fleeing from persecution and discrimination in Eastern Europe. So we're talking about Jews who are fleeing from pogroms in Russia, or Jews in Poland and elsewhere in Eastern Europe who face severe discrimination. So these were people who, in some cases, were fleeing for their lives, and at the very least were looking for a new life where they would not face discrimination and persecution.
And how were they able to come? Were they able to get visas, or was the immigration process not that complicated then?
Until 1921, America basically had open doors, so pretty much anybody could come in to the United States, and the bulk of the American Jewish community as we know it today really comes from those giant waves of immigration. But it's important to keep in mind, in terms of the history of Orthodox Judaism in America, that a large majority of Jews coming from Eastern Europe were not Orthodox, or let's say were in the process of giving up their religious observance. So the Orthodox community began in the U.S. During this period in a very weakened state, because the people who were coming, the Jewish immigrants who were coming, were those who were the least likely to be particularly frum. The frumest stayed behind in the shtetl in Eastern Europe.
Wow. And when they came, when these people came, they were already met with a somewhat established Jewish community, German Jewish community that had, I don't know if they had assimilated, they certainly had changed a lot of the culture and the customs, no longer traditional Judaism.
Well, there were several hundred thousand Jews in America by the late 1800s, but most of them had had come from Germany, and very few of them were Orthodox. So those Jewish immigrants who came later and wanted to live an observant lifestyle found many, many obstacles. It wasn't at all like we're accustomed to today. The basics of Orthodox Jewish life in America were very fragile, and the even ordinary things like obtaining kosher food or being able to observe Shabbat without interference, these things were very difficult for those generations.
And then when they came, I guess, you know, you say in the article there were really two groups. Let's talk about them. What you call resistors and accommodators. So let's talk about the resistors and the accommodators. Who were they and what did they stand for?
Well, the resistors were that segment of the Orthodox community in America whom today we would call Haredim. So these were, for example, rabbis who were part of the group known as the Agudas HaRabbanim, and they supported insulating the Orthodox community as much as possible from the outside world. Now, the accommodators were those who today we would refer to as the modern Orthodox, who believed it was possible to live to be part of American society without necessarily having to compromise Jewish religious observance. So there was a kind of a tug of war going on within the Orthodox community between those who did not want to, for example, have English in their day school curricula, who wanted to maintain Yiddish as the spoken language, let's say for when a rabbi gave a drusha in shul on Shabbos, and in general tried to separate from the outside world, and those, the modern Orthodox, who felt that one could introduce, for example, English into sermons, and who were not afraid of secular studies as long as they were alongside traditional Orthodox Judaic studies.
And they were actually the accommodators, quote, were the people who really were the founders of the OU, Rabbi Mendez and Drachman and lay leaders like Albert Lucas and Louis Dembitz. Those were the people who were really the accommodators, and they were the founders of the OU because they believed that Orthodoxy could thrive in America despite the fact that, you know, it would change. It wouldn't be exactly like it was in Europe.
They looked at what was happening to Jewish observance in America, and they wanted to come up with ways to accommodate the realities of American life without having to compromise on Orthodox principles. So sometimes that meant, for example, looking for ways to attract young people so that you know the younger Jewish immigrants and children of immigrants would not automatically drift away from Judaism. And here's an example. The Blue Laws, which were widely in effect in those days, required all businesses to be open, to be closed on Sundays. That put tremendous pressure on young Jewish entrepreneurs to keep their businesses open on Shabbos. The result of that was that a Jewish shopkeeper, after having his shop open during the day on Shabbos, would then be free only late in the afternoon. So the early founders of the OU, among other things, initiated a number of what they call young people synagogues. And these were typically in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, which made the Shabbos Mincha service the major service of the day, because that was when young people would be able to attend. So they could have taken the attitude that, well, they're desecrating Shabbos, so we don't care about their needs, and we'll just stick to what we're used to. Or instead, they took an attitude of what we today would call outreach. They tried to speak to young Jews in their language and to meet them on their terms and to offer them a Shabbat experience, which, even though it was a little unusual for Shabbos Mincha to be the major, the focal point of Shabbos, still it offered them an experience which could help keep them within the Jewish fold at a time when there was no realistic hope of convincing them to close their shops on Shabbos. And it would take years before the Blue Laws were finally rescinded, and it was much more feasible for Jewish business owners to, you know, to close their stores on Saturday because they didn't have to close them on Sunday. But until then, the question facing the modern Orthodox leadership, as we call it, or the OU leadership, was, well, how to deal with American reality while at the same time trying to ensure the continuity of Orthodox Judaism in this situation.
And yet it was also interesting that some of the things that they were fighting for way back when in the early 1900s were things that they were going to have to fight for many, many, many years, such as not having to take a test on a Shabbos or Shechita, and people who were working were able to get a leave of absence for a Yontif. Exactly the things that I think today, as a matter of fact, we're still fighting for that today. I mean, it's better, but we're still fighting for that today.
In some cases, that's true. The early OU was fighting for Jewish concerns on multiple fronts. So on the one hand, they were engaged in outreach to try to keep young people within the Orthodox fold. And at the same time, as you note, they were involved in these battles to make it possible for young Jews, for example, to take different types of licensing exams without having to take them on Shabbos. There were other issues like quotas on Jewish students being admitted to American universities. Now, today, that's unimaginable. But in the early 1900s, that was a real problem for young Jews who wanted to go to college and make a better life for themselves and advance to socioeconomic levels, you know, beyond what their parents could have achieved. And yet here, you know, there were quotas enforced at a major American university. So these were these were battles that the OU fought, and they did make progress. But yes, there's an ongoing struggle, and so even today, sometimes there are issues like this. But I think we've come very far in terms of how American society now tries to accommodate religious minorities, including Orthodox Jews.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. And you're right about this very interesting situation that happened way back when in 1906. It sounds like a long time ago. And where they actually, the Board of Education, insisted that the kids had to write compositions about Christmas. And Albert Lucas, who was the secretary and one of the founders of OU, appealed to the Board of Education. And eventually they won. Why don't you tell us what happened? It sounds interesting.
It's an interesting case study in how Jewish activists are sometimes received when they raise their voices in protest. In this case, Albert Lucas, who was a prominent lay leader of the early OU, became aware that Jewish students in public schools, and in those days there were very few private Jewish schools, so most Jewish kids, most Orthodox kids were in the public schools, often found themselves being pressured by their teachers to either sing Christmas carols or to write, you know, compositions on their favorite part of Christmas, that sort of thing. Some of the teachers might have been motivated by, you know, missionary desires, and some of them were probably just doing what they were used to in terms of what most kids were doing in school. But either way, it was something that was very uncomfortable for Jewish children. And when Albert Lucas first protested to the Board of Education, they dismissed him as a radical. They called him an extremist, and they at first refused to listen to his protest. And what he did is he spread the word in the community. He was what we might call a community organizer. He let parents know what was happening, and the result was a community-wide strike by parents in which they kept their children out of school in protest, and that very quickly resulted in the Board of Education giving in and instructing teachers not to compel Jewish students to do anything related to Christmas. So it was a striking victory, and it set an important precedent in terms of separating church and state on the local level, and in trying to ward off pressure on Jewish children to become too Americanized, in this case, almost to embrace Christian traditions.
Well, you know, he sounds like an interesting individual, Albert Lucas, because when you read a little bit about him in your article, you see that he also did something else, which is really understanding about these Christian-run settlement houses on the Lower East Side, which were quasi-missionary, and he started the JCA, the Jewish Centers Association, which, of course, whenever you try to do something good, there's always opposition. So he had opposition both from, I guess, the more secular type of Jews and the more religious type of Jews who were opposed to it. Let's talk about that. That also sounds like an incredible story.
Well, in this case, Lucas ran into unexpected opposition from within the Jewish community. When the Jewish Centers Association was established and they sought to create what they call Jewish centers within heavily Jewish neighborhoods in order to compete with the Christian groups that had such places, they called settlement houses, he found that some of the assimilated prominent German-born Jews in the community were opposed to these Jewish center activities, these Jewish outreach work. They thought that Lucas and the other OU activists were exaggerating, that there wasn't a need for this kind of thing. And in fact, many of the German Jewish leaders in America felt that the Christian settlement houses were actually useful in that they were helping immigrants to Americanize. So for those Jews who favored more assimilation, more Americanization, these settlement houses didn't seem so terrible. And so that was a problem for Lucas in trying to raise the funds necessary to create these Jewish centers. And very much for that reason, to a significant extent, because he couldn't raise those funds. The Jewish Centers Association did not get very far. But it did lay the groundwork, however, for continuing outreach efforts by modern Orthodox Jews and eventually helped pave the way for the emergence of the Young Israel movement, which turned out, of course, to be a tremendous success in terms of combining Americanism and Orthodoxy.
It's interesting when you say that. So what do you think happened if the OU was so much involved in all of this? So how did the Young Israel movement start? Why wasn't it the OU movement? Do you know anything about it at all? I don't.
Well, they all come from the same roots. In other words, you mentioned the Jewish Centers Association. They had an outreach group called the Jewish Endeavor Society. The OU, the Young Israel, they all came from sort of the same group of activists, Rabbi Bernard Drachman, Rabbi Mendez Pereira, Albert Lucas, and others. These were a group of Orthodox activists who recognized that it would be possible to have both. You could be American and you could also be Orthodox. So when Rabbi Henry Pereira Mendez or Drachman first advocated this approach, they were isolated. This wasn't a mass movement. They were pioneers, as was Albert Lucas, and they were introducing something that was new. Early on, many Jewish immigrants thought that their choice was basically between Judaism and becoming American. And for the vast majority, they jettisoned their Jewishness and they embraced Americanism. And what these early founders of the OU and Young Israel demonstrated was that it was possible to have both. And certainly history has proven them to be correct.
Right. And then I think the last part, really, I want to just talk a little bit about the role of the OU women's branch, which really was so instrumental in changing things because, as you write, until 1920 is when women were given the right to vote, things changed, and this was not lost on the fact that this changed the OU completely because the OU now had a women's branch and I think an incredible person I've read about, which was, Rebbetzin Goldstein and her role in establishing the Women's Sisterhood Division of the OU and what they did. So maybe we could just talk a little bit about their role in Jewish history.
Well, it's no coincidence that as women in America began to gain greater rights in the 1920s, with the right to vote and more of a role in society, that changing attitude also affected the Orthodox community. And Orthodox women began looking at what was happening for women, to women, in society in general, and they began to push for greater participation in Orthodox life. Rebecca, or Betty Goldstein, who was the wife of Rabbi Herbert Goldstein from the Upper West Side, was a very important pioneer in the 1920s as the head of the OU women's branch at the same time that her husband was the president of OU. This is the mid-1920s into the early and mid-1930s. They again, looked at a situation in which Jewish girls were not receiving a substantial education. The Beis Yaakov movement as such, barely existed. It had only been established in 1917 in Poland. So Jewish girls they were at disadvantage, and the role of Jewish women in Orthodox life was very limited. And under Betty Goldstein, however, a number of changes began to take place. First of all, a number of OU synagogues began giving women the right to be full members. Until then, they were simply part of their husband's membership. So as full members, they could actually vote when there was something to be voted upon in shul.
Like the rabbi's contract or something like that, right?
Well, whatever the issue was, for the first time, women could actually vote. And that was, that was a big change. In terms of homemaking, women, and most Jewish women, most Orthodox women in those days were homemakers. There were also a number of changes in the world around them, which which changed their role too. I'm just talking about things like the introduction of frozen foods. Refrigerators were only first became common in homes after 1911. The kinds of things that were changing everyone's lives also were affecting Orthodox homes, and women were stepping into the modern world. Orthodox women were stepping into the modern world as well and looking for ways to play a greater role in Jewish life. Now, what Betty Goldstein did was of particular significance was that the women's division began pressing very actively for more sophisticated and systematic supervision of kosher, of the production of kosher foods. The OU's Kashrut division was still in its infancy, but it was constant pressure from the women's branch to increase inspection of manufacturing plants and to actively promote supervision that made a big difference in Jewish life. People joke today about how back in those days, you would simply have to check in the ingredients on the side of a box of food because there were because the OU symbol was not on many products yet. It was a different time, and that led to a lot of people eating foods that today probably would not be considered appropriate. So, but pressure from the grassroots, that is pressure from the women and from the women's branch, led to a significant expansion of the kashrut supervision activity. In fact, Rebbetzin Goldstein herself often went with other women's branch officials to personally inspect food plants and to expand the whole system of kashrut supervision. So in today's world, of course, we're very used to walking into any supermarket and seeing hundreds of different products with supervision, but it was a long and hard-fought effort, beginning with Orthodox women in the 1920s, that got us to the point where we are today.
Right, and I think that's really the message, that these people were really incredible. What they did, they really were the backbone, the foundation of what we have today. And I'm glad you really wrote the article and have this interview, and I hope a lot of people will be listening to it, because we owe a tremendous hakaras hatov to these group of people. They were the rocks, and they were there, and they helped everyone. Listen, Dr. Medoff, it was really fantastic talking to you. I look forward to reading some other articles that you're writing, and we sincerely appreciate everything you've done for us at the Orthodox Union. So have a wonderful, wonderful day. Be well.
Thank you very much.